We're ready to go. Open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Monday, April 20th. For those in the audience and watching, this is going to be a very interesting week in this building. So, we're not going to go exactly in order today. If you're here for Senate Bill 101, it'll be the last one we hear today. I can't tell you when, but I know it will not be before 2:15. So we're going to start by opening up a work session.
Morse is still here.
We're going to start by... You're waiting for someone, Senator Morse. Cretho? Okay. Start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 171. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 171 prohibits construction of physical hazard air navigation without first obtaining permit from the Oregon Department of Aviation. The -7 amendment is the one we have done the paperwork on. It replaces the measure prohibits construction of physical hazards to air navigation as determined by the Oregon Department of Aviation in coordination with local land use jurisdictions. It authorizes the Director of Aviation to establish standards for mitigating hazards to air navigation. It authorizes the Director of Aviation to require that airports take actions to mitigate hazards to air navigation, and it provides exemptions for cell towers and for persons who have received FAA approval or have applied for FAA approval.
Mr. Clem, if you want to come forward and explain your amendment and how we have come to this conclusion.
Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Transportation Business Committee, my name is Dan Clem. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. Senate Bill 171, with the proposed -7 amendment, attempts to alleviate and address all the concerns that have been expressed here to date without putting airspace safety at the risk of any local land use jurisdiction, but completely within the purview and comment and authority of the land use jurisdiction. So it actually nicely puts together airspace safety along with respecting local land use jurisdiction with regard to constructing tall structures that penetrate the surfaces. By clarification, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are many structures that penetrate airspace. Trees virtually around every airport penetrate the horizontal surface. Large tanks, hillsides that were there before the airport penetrate the airspace surface. We're really talking about those particular penetrations of the horizontal surface around concentric circles around an airport that really cause potential threat to airspace navigation. As I've brought to you before, the unique issue involving wind towers in various parts of Oregon was one of the reasons for bringing this bill forward. But really at the heart of this bill is the need to put the state in the process of commenting on these penetrations that are deemed hazards. Right now it's between someone constructing and the FAA. The state has no authority to be involved in the FERC process. I hope I'm saying that right, but the Energy Facility Siting Council process, and with Section 4 that would allow the Oregon Department of Aviation to be involved early on in the process as opposed to sometimes or never. Also, the airport managers and local land use jurisdictions were concerned that if you had the state making hazard determinations and the Federal Aviation Administration making hazard determinations, that might be problematic. Therefore, we made the changes to Section 3 that essentially allow the Oregon Department of Aviation to make recommendations, not direct, that airport navigational aids be altered in any way. So we have the responsibility of establishing the standards for lighting and marking, and then also for determining a hazard and whether that hazard should be altered in height or location. But beyond that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we feel that the -7 is respects the local land use authorities and still provides us the ability to intervene and to assist local land use jurisdictions trying to make decisions before they are past the planning stage. Also allows us to, if we disagree with the Federal Aviation Administration, which is such the case now with the wind towers near the Wasco State Airport, this would give me the authority to do so. I would point to this if the FAA ever questioned that. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that I can.
Okay, I think before we do, does any of the local governing bodies want to comment on the -7 amendment that have been working on this? Okay. Okay, any questions for Mr. Clem then?
Mr. Chair, I do have one other fact. In Section 2, the on or before the effective date of this 2009 Act, this was put in place to out of respect for those things that have already been approved. We would like to take another look at the Energy Facility Siting Council process to ensure that this absoluteness of this statement is something that doesn't conflict with other processes that we haven't been a part of yet. So we're going to, I just wanted on the record that we still want to take another look at this, what the Energy Facility and Siting Council process is, but we feel that this bill is ready to go and really allows us the ability to intervene and also tell the FAA what the state of Oregon thinks in terms of a proposed structure.
Okay, thanks.
Point of work session?
Yes.
I move the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 171.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 171. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 171 as amended by the Dash 7 to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 171 as amended by the Dash 7 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion?
Just, Mr. Chair, a comment. Yes. I appreciate Mr. Klum's, you know, consistent work on this and tenacity, I think. You know, I think ultimately we're on the Dash 7, so it you know, it didn't happen on the first try, so sometimes tenacity pays off. So.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? So ordered. And I think I will ask Senator Johnson to carry just because she's our aviation. If she does not wish to, I will carry. You might as well stay where you are, Mr. Klum. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 439.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 439 directs the Economic Community Development Department to establish a program for the creation of tax increment financing districts for rural airports. You have the Dash 3 amendment, which combines the previous Dash 1s with the 2s. Let me describe the ones, the twos, and then I'll explain what the Dash 3 adds. Dash 1 changes the membership of airport public-private partnerships committees to include representatives of overlapping taxing districts. Dash 2 clarifies that tax increment financing districts may be created with the participation of at least one city, one county, or a taxing district, with only participating taxing districts providing the partial rebates. It allows eligible non-participating entities to begin participation at any time. The Dash 3 combines those, and then it also excludes the Aurora State Airport.
Thank you. And among the reasons we did that is that the only opposition we heard, but it was very loud, was about the Aurora State Airport, although we were talking about 70-some airports. And so we thought it would be best to put that issue aside and see if the policy itself is good for going forward. So,
Mr. Chairman, I also wanted to point out that we do have fiscal and revenue statements on this, but it is, has a subsequent referral to the Finance and Revenue Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Klem, your comments on the Dash 3.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Dan Klem, Director of Oregon Department of Aviation. The Dash 3 amendment really is intended to address some of the concerns voiced at the last work session and public hearing with regard to this complete opt-in, opt-out provision. Also, Legislative Council felt that much of the language contained on the first page in lines 4 through 17 and then also on the second page in lines 3 through 8, which is found in on page 2 of the amendment, really wanted to clarify that it's a complete opt-in, opt-out. If a city or county, the elected officials representing those jurisdictions, those taxing jurisdictions, did not want to participate in allocating tax increment for airport improvements, that we wanted to go overboard in making sure that that was painfully aware, obvious in this. Also, there was concerns, Mr. Chair, with regard to services. You generally don't see anything but hard capital construction in an urban renewal type bill. Again, I want to reiterate this is not urban renewal, but in fact, you generally only see hard construction. We felt that it was important that we define services as requested directly related to the operation, repair, and maintenance of airport infrastructure. There are a number of navigational aids or, in fact, water sewer systems that could be installed at an airport that would require services to be paid for that may not be available out of the municipality or the airport sponsor's budget. So we did provide that additional piece. Also included the Economic Development Department in any of the rebate process. And very importantly, when wanted to make sure that this public-private partnership, the airport sponsor and all of those that opt in to the process in this tax increment district, that they had an equal voice on the committee that governs the planning and the expenditure of funds. So we added the one-fourth of the members of that public-private partnership must represent the local property taxing jurisdictions that approve formation of the airport district. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we want to make sure everybody had a voice, even after they opted in for the tax increment, as to how the money was spent and exactly what it was to be spent for, to include the rebates. So we think we've included everybody. We've made this an opt-in, opt-out bill. Would appreciate your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Plum. Questions for Mr. Clem? Senator Berger.
Yes, under your bill, I haven't read the dash too thoroughly enough. I was trying to see. Is your position still the one that is the supervisor of the district? In other words, are you the head of the tax increment district as director of the department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the airport sponsor I'm not in charge. The airport sponsor, with the taxing jurisdictions, decide that they want to form this airport district. They take it to the Economic Development Department, who tends to have programs and bureaucracy already established to oversee infrastructure-type programs and grants and loan-type financing programs. My department and my position are not involved in any approval or disapproval process. The Commission of the Oregon Economic Community Development, by requirement, has got to oversee what all the parties have come to agree to in terms of tax increments. So the Oregon Department of Aviation is not involved in that.
Follow-up, please. Yeah. So that differs from urban renewal or enterprise zones?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, that is correct. That differs. The intent was not to disrupt or compete or create some alternate scheme of urban renewal here, Senator Berger. The intent here was to take a look at the need for urban services and infrastructure out in the rural areas and allow all of those taxing jurisdictions with their elected officials to make that decision and then have the Economic Community Development Commission discern that made sense at the state level. Also, the Department of Aviation is mentioned in the bill as providing assistance as necessary or requested.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Any other questions for Director Clem? Senator Schrader.
Yeah, the one issue I still seem to have with this, even though you're trying to make this somewhat different than urban renewal, is that you still do seem to have an agency that has jurisdiction over the kinds of projects that are put forward, whereas in any other mechanism of this kind, it usually is an elected body that has to go through a process where, if there are any, for instance, amendments to the kinds and types of projects, that has to be an open and public process and discussion and on record. So how is that different than that process? I mean, that's a huge concern.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, the issue at hand is that the Economic Community Development Commission would allow the formation, or it would vote to allow the formation of the tax increment district, and it would do so with an initial list, projects list. So you're correct that they have purview on it. One of the reasons for doing that is that they may already have corresponding or adjoining or nearby or being considered water sewer infrastructure or other types of infrastructure and economic community development projects nearby. The idea was to allow that to create synergy, to allow multiple ideas and projects to move forward. So it really was in the context of letting Economic Community Development Department be involved, because they may already be considering economic community development projects nearby or that would be able to help the airport. The issue here is that they would approve the initial projects list, but in fact that public-private partnership they have the sole vote in terms of how those projects move forward and how the rebates are handled. So every time a decision is made, the intent is not that the Economic Community Development Commission be making that decision. They approve the formation like they do a number of other projects.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think this is bad policy. Mm-hmm. I just feel strongly that it's bad policy. I think there is a way to do this to assist airports reforming airport districts, I think, is the way to go. I think you let the people decide. I think that you get strong local support. And I think that it does not involve a state government being involved in it. Small rural airports, which this is a tool to try to help small rural airports get bigger and better at what they do. And you can do that, but I do not believe that tax increment financing in districts are the way to go. I think it's very poor policy.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Clinton.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
It appears to me that we're going to invest in small rural airports in a different way than perhaps this bill suggests.
And that might solve some of those issues. Thank you, Director Clem, for all your work on this bill, and as with the other one. But I have a sense from the committee we're not ready for this one yet. But hopefully you'll be pleased, as Senator Starr said, with some other directions we're going with airports in the next week or so. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 439 and open a work session on Senate Bill 623, Water. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, this is one of the few bills this week without an amendment. This is Senate Bill 623. You heard this on the 1st of April. Directs the Public Utility Commission to allow higher water rates for metered water systems serving fewer than 500 customers to encourage metered water systems. You have reports of no expenditure impact and no fiscal impact on this.
Okay. We heard this bill before. We had no opposition to the bill at that time. I will ask if there's anybody in the audience who would like to speak in opposition before we go into work session on this bill. Okay.
Are we in work session?
We are.
Mr. Jarvis, I would move that we send Senate Bill 623 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 623 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and we'll ask Senator Johnson to carry. Okay, now we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 849. Mr. Stembridge.
Senate Bill 849 is the bill that establishes statewide audio newspaper service within the Public Utilities Commission. You have the dash 2, which directs the State Library to administer the statewide audio newspaper service. It directs the PUC to transfer to the State Library Donation Fund $70,000 per biennium from the Residential Service Protection Fund, that's the RSPF, for the purpose of funding the service. That declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2009.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And colleagues, as you recall, we heard this bill, and I think the committee was moved by the testimony of those folks who are blind and use the National Newsline service and the concern that it might go away for lack of funding. And so I had the dash 2 written because I do believe it is a telecommunications device and it is consistent with the Residential Service Protection Fund, and came up with an appropriation from that fund of $35,000 a year or $70,000 a biennium. I selected that figure because on the low end, this biennium is intended to cost about $32,000, but it could go up to $100,000. And my thinking on this was I wasn't interested in saying we're going to pay for all of this, but to provide a base of funding for these folks, recognizing that those who are receiving donations need to continue to provide donations to the fund to serve more people who may be subscribers. But at least this would provide a safety net for the Newsline service. The original bill, sets in motion, or at least theoretically sets in motion, another service besides Newsline. And I, all our testimony was on supporting the existing service, and I thought this would be an appropriate way to go. So what I want to do is hear from folks on this today, and we'll go from there. And I'm not going to move it today. My intent would be to move it Wednesday after we hear from folks today. So in this case, anyone who would like to testify on the amendment, dash 2 to 849, would please come forward at this time. Anybody? There we go.
Good Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Chepke. I'm the state librarian, the director of the state library. And my testimony today is that the State Library Board supports Senate Bill 849. The -2 amendment would accomplish the goal of providing sustainable base funding for the Newsline service at the State Library. We've been running this service for 3 years now. We have 849 people all over the state that use this service. We are funding it with donations from the State Library, the Oregon Commission for the Blind, and the NFB Oregon, but we're concerned about our ability to continue to support this important service in that way. Our donations are down about 6% this year, as are most people that collect donations. We're all experiencing the same problem. So this -2 amendment would achieve the goal of providing base funding for this very important service for Oregonians.
Okay. I wanted to ask you one question. We did, or at least I did, hear from one individual who was suggesting that there were excess funds that the library had that could be used for this program, and I'd like to have you comment on that, if that's in fact accurate or not.
Mr. Chair, that is not accurate. This program is in our talking book and braille services, and the main service that we provide is a book lending service to about 5,000 Oregonians across the state. We do that with 9 FTE and with another 2 FTE volunteers every day. And we send out about 1,300 books a day. It's a very excellent service, but it's difficult for us now to provide it. The Newsline service is in addition to that service, and we took on the responsibility for Newsline without any additional staff or any additional resources. So we're really, we feel that we're doing everything we can to serve blind and print disabled Oregonians with these library services, and I'm not aware of any extra money that we have at this time.
And then, and just to make it understanding, if we move forward with this, the intention is to provide, again, a kind of a safety net. It's not an expectation that if you have more subscribers that that we're going to come back and provide any additional, but to ensure that a base level of funding for these folks is here, and you'll continue to solicit the donations from the various interest groups that we have in the past.
Yes, that's true, Mr. Chair. And And I think having this base funding in place means that if we do experience further reductions in donations, it won't hurt our ability to deliver this basic service. On the other hand, if we don't have, if we can maintain our donations, another thing that could happen is that we could meet with the Oregon Commission for the Blind and the NFB of Oregon and discuss how to expand the Newsline to have more newspapers, because right now it only has the Oregonian, the Register Guard, and the Statesman Journal. And I know a lot of people in Southern Oregon would love to see the Mail Tribune. It would be great to have the Ben Bulletin, the East Oregonian. So there is great demand to have more newspapers, so we might be able to do that with some of our donation funds in the future.
Okay. Senator George.
Mr. Chair, I think that some of the research you heard about was something that came out of my office, and so let me go into a little more detail. Staff in my office were instructed to go through all of the ending fund balances of all of the state agencies, and the state library had, according to what legislative fiscal gave us, a $1.9 million ending fund balance. And so trying to figure out, I mean, here, what we're dealing with is that this is an expansion of a new program, and we're raiding funds over in a totally separate fund. And I'm trying to figure out why the stream of revenue into the state library would be such that you guys would have that you would report a $1.9 million ending fund balance.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, some of that may be our talking book and braille services endowment fund, which is a fund that we began about 10 years ago, and I think it's up to about $800,000 now. And our board's policy in creating that endowment would be to dedicate those funds that were given to us to supporting Talking Book and Braille services in the future when we can generate enough interest from that endowment to support the program. But right now, we're still just trying to grow that endowment, and we haven't begun to spend that endowment. The interest on that amount of money, frankly, doesn't make that much of a difference right now, particularly with interest rates as they are right now. So that's probably part of that balance. The other part of that balance is that we also provide library service to state agencies, and we have an assessment on state agencies, and that is actually a large part of our budget. And we were advised a number of years ago by the Audits Division of the Secretary of State that we should have a 3-month ending balance because that is assessment funded, and I think that's kind of the standard in state government. The services that are funded by assessments actually carry a 3-month ending balance. So I think that makes up another big chunk of that figure. So both of those, and it would be inappropriate to use assessments on state agencies to fund the Talking Book and Braille services, because those funds are given to us by statute to support our library service to state agencies. So it would be inappropriate to use those monies to pay for Newsline. It would also be inappropriate to use our endowment fund to pay for Newsline, because we promised the people that gave to the endowment that we'd only use the interest on the endowment fund for that.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
comment. I guess here's what it is. I think we all support the program. It's just when we talk about the appropriateness, and you have two reasons why current funds coming into the state library would be inappropriate. And I kind of view that the way this bill is structured and the amendment structured is also equally inappropriate as far as a funding source. I mean, it seems like to me that this is either a general fund flow of money that should come in, or some kind of other revenue that we should supply to the state library, rather than going over to the PUC and raiding a fund that's over there. You see my problem. I'm sort of stuck. If there isn't some other creative way we can come up with financing that flows either directly to the state library or uses existing funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think when we started this program 3 years ago, we looked at all the possibilities for funding the Newsline, and the only thing we could come up with at the time was to use some of our additional donations that don't go to the endowment fund to fund the Newsline, and we are spending about $11,500 a year of donations for the Newsline. But there's no other place in the state library budget where at that time we could find any extra funds, and that's even more true today. In fact, the rebalance of the current biennium budget involved a reduction in funds to Talking Book and Braille services of, I think, $43,000 that we projected an ending balance this biennium. And so that money has already been taken out of our Talking Book and Braille services budget. I would also say that this bill was not sponsored by the state library. So it was never our idea to use this PUC fund. It was an idea of the National Library Federation of Oregon, and I just want to be clear about this. This wasn't an agency bill.
Okay. I'm sorry I wasn't here earlier, Mr. Chair, as far as comment on this. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for the state librarian? Senator Berger.
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to tell you that my aunt spent a lifetime in the profession of teaching the deaf. And in the latter years of her life, she became blind. And it was through the library service that she had a daily routine of listening to the audiobooks and so many chapters a day. Mm-hmm. And it offered her a quality of life that was very similar to yours or mine.
Yes.
And so I just want to thank you so much for the service that you offer to many people and the joy that they have on a daily basis from that service.
Thank you, Senator Berger. I appreciate that.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, kind of following up on Senator George's line of questioning. So I understand you're currently carrying about a 3-month supply in your budget. What amount of money is that?
I would have to get back to you on that.
Well, if you've got, again, if
but the point about that is, it's the assessment that we do.
I understand that.
From
I understand
the agencies,
that.
But I can get you that number.
The reality is, I mean, it's up to the committee, but the reality is that the legislature could change the statute relatively easily, and you know, currently the assessment says, you know, it's going to go to the X programs, and this legislature can say and something else.
Yes.
So, but the question is the money there to support, you know, basically, I don't know, what are we looking at, $3,000 a month for this particular program? And so if you've got 1.9 in your ending fund balance and 800,000 of that is in the one fund, that tells me you got $1.1 million. Apparently that's 3 months worth of budget, which tells me that that's a significant chunk of dollars.
Yes.
And $3,000, perhaps $3,000 a month would not be, put a crimp in the agency ability to continue to operate and provide the services that you do so ably to state government. So just some thoughts to think about.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to comment on 849?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I testified earlier on this bill, and you have some written comments from the association. Regarding the Dash 2 amendments, and speaking with some of my colleagues, I guess the conclusion we reached is that we would prefer, rather than a continuous appropriation, maybe a one-time appropriation from some source, and then have the proponents of the bill come maybe to the Telecommunications Devices Access Program Advisory Committee and discuss this issue and see if there's some common ground that we can all come to on this matter. As a member of that committee, I can tell you that we have not heard from the proponents of this measure until the session began. So I would just throw that out. And then if you will indulge me maybe in speaking to the bill itself again, I don't want to be redundant, but the association...
Redundancy is good in communication. You know,
okay.
We're building it all
allow
the time.
Me to be redundant then. We don't believe this is a telecommunications service. The Residential Service Protection Fund clearly is designed to assist people communicate with one another and with the outside world, with folks who are hearing, and just connect folks who can't hear with those folks. The News Reader service is a subscription service, in our opinion, and it's something that you can subscribe to and take advantage of. And we just don't feel like the Residential Service Protection Fund is the proper place to get the funds to subsidize that versus the other programs that are currently being paid for by that fund. So I wanted to say that one more time for the record, and I'll close there and answer any questions if you have any.
Thanks, Brent. Any other questions for Brent?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. We'll be putting this back on, roll this over till Wednesday. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 849. And you ready to go, Senator Morris? Let's open our work session on Senate Bill 915, Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 915, the original bill required that municipal penalties for violation of local building code be no more than penalties for violation of corresponding state building code provisions. You have the Dash 4, and we have not received the paperwork on the Dash 4 yet, but the Dash 4 replaces the measure. It requires municipal building inspection penalties to be assessed as civil penalties. It requires that notice be provided to civil penalty recipients. It specifies the content of that notice. It limits the amount of municipal civil penalty to no more than the amount authorized in state building code, and it applies retroactively.
Senator Morris, you want to discuss your amendment for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, Frank Morris, representing District 8, Albany Corvallis in the Senate. The Dash 4 amendments are the reflection of an ongoing process with the stakeholders. We started out with a work group with council, legislative council, realizing that this issue, as it penetrates into the various jurisdictions of the state, needs to be crafted in a way that does not impinge on local jurisdictions' ability to enforce building codes, but rather to set the broad guidelines. And you'll remember that the precipitating event for this bill was an occasion in my district where enforcement of the building code was under the criminal code procedures in the municipal court. And what this amendment does, it makes it very clear that that process will not be a criminal code procedure process, but will rather be a civil proceeding. But what we tried to do is to just set the broad guidelines and then allow each jurisdiction the ability to enforce it and create their own codes based on their needs. And it's interesting to observe, has been for me, to see the variation that it actually has occurred within municipalities as to how this enforcement is conducted. But what it does, it makes it clear that it's a civil process, civil penalty, and not a requirement that it must be a civil process. The other thing that I would mention to you is Section 3, and I have represented that this is not an attempt to look back to the City of Corvallis's issue with Mr. McElroy. What Legislative Council has advised me is that anytime you do this kind of action, you need a point of beginning. The point of beginning would be January 1 of 2010, and it would apply to a new civil penalty. And the procedure is prospective, irrespective of when the violation occurred. So Legislative Council has assured me that my intent with respect to the City of Corvallis and Mr. McElroy has not been influenced. But it is a forward-looking, this is the point of beginning, and it's forward-looking. I also, Mr. Chair and colleagues, have given you a letter that I have provided to the Government Ethics Commission with respect to my role in helping Mr. McElroy, and that if, in fact, there are any retirements of the loans that I have provided to him, any interest or principal will not accrue to me or my wife personally, but will accrue to the benefit of the Albany Boys and Girls Club and the Corvallis Boys and Girls Club. So I want to make that very, very clear that there is no, I have no financial interest in this bill. I do have an interest in setting policy in this state that precludes what happened to Mr. McElroy from happening in other jurisdictions. And so with that, Mr. Chair and colleagues, I'd be happy to respond to questions. And I know that we have interested parties in the room, and they may wish to make comment as well. But what we have attempted to do is to bring together in the work group a consensus that would allow us to move this bill forward. There may be some minor kind of word changes that would be requested in the House side, and I'm pleased to work on those if that would occur on the House side.
Thank you, Senator. Thanks for your work on this issue. Questions for Senator Morris? Okay, thank you. Okay, I know we have members of the work group work with Senator Morris in the room. Who else would like to comment on the amendment to this bill? Mr. Cross or anyone else want to comment on this? You have one opportunity to comment.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. We work with Senator Morris on crafting these provisions and appreciate his willingness to work with the different local government units, and we are generally satisfied. Most jurisdictions have something in play already that it contains many of these components that have been outlined that would be required now by statute. So frankly, it's probably a good path to follow.
Okay. A few others have joined you.
Chair
Barenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg, representing the City of Portland. We, too, very much appreciate all the work the Senator has done in listening to the concerns that we've had. he probably knows more about the building codes now than he's ever really wanted to, I think. For the City of Portland, we have no objections to the language that was included, with one issue that just came up today, a minor issue that is a Portland-specific reference in the general laws to how court cases are handled in these matters, enforcing city ordinances and charter for cities of over 300,000. And we've spoken to the senator about that and look forward to working with him as this moves over to the House and addressing that issue. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the League of Oregon Cities. We too appreciate Senator Morse's willingness to listen to the concerns brought forth by the League as well as other parties in the course of this process. The bottom line is that the Dash 4 amendments, from our perspective, provide a framework that we can agree to moving forward. We thank the committee for allowing the time to work through this process. We know that there's a couple parties to the discussions that have concerns about specific details, and look forward to continuing those discussions on the House side. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Rick.
I have a question for David Barenberg. David, in the first testimony, now you refer to, is this the municipal court that you're referring to, the little
No, sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the City of Portland does not have a municipal court, and their specific statutory language on three, looked in an ORS chapter earlier than I think I've ever looked at it, 3.136, which talks about how cases from the city go to the courts. The city has a process currently where it has administrative appeals and then a appeals board for handling issues, and beyond that they then go to the circuit court.
Does it have any criminal consequences to it at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, what the city does currently is processes all of them as civil matters. Under our charter, we have a ability to bring and enforce our charter and code through the courts, which is also captured in statute. It's not something that we have done to the best of anybody's recollection, but it is an authority that the city has had.
I see. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you all. What I would like to do, and Mr. Barenberg brought up this, what he said was not a major issue, and because this is our week, and I know Senator Morris will take care of that issue on the House side. We don't have a fiscal on the bill yet, but what I would like to do is adopt the Dash 4 amendment. Mm-hmm. We'll have a fiscal, hopefully then, to bring this back Wednesday, so that we can move it on and then give it to the House of Representatives. And it appears we have good consensus on the bill. We'll get the final tweak put in over there. But I do appreciate all the work on where we started from and trying to address an issue that, while has clearly not been a dominant issue in local government, we want to make sure that it is universal in local government. So that would be helpful. So I would entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 4.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 915. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and we'll bring the bill back on Wednesday for work session with a fiscal, hopefully, by then. Okay, now we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 867. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 867 authorizes accountants licensed in other states to practice public accountancy in Oregon if the accountant's requirements for licensing qualifications are substantially equivalent to Oregon's without notification or payment of fees to the Oregon Board of Accountancy. We have last Friday received the Dash 2s. The Dash 2 amendment provides technical changes in wording for clarification of intent. It clarifies definition of substantial equivalency. It directs the board to investigate complaints made by another state's accountancy board. It places the Board of Accountancy permit fees in statute at annual rates of $160 for initial application or renewal and $175 for business organization.
Okay, Mr. Douglas, you and anyone you'd like to bring up as proponents of the bill to talk about the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. With me today is Steve McConnell from the OSCPA Legislative Committee. The amendment that is before you, the fee aspect of that amendment is our attempt to relieve the Board of Accountancy of any fiscal impact from this measure, and that goes to the purpose of the amendment.
Okay. Any comments, Mr. McConnell?
I want to thank the Senate Administrator. I want to thank the committee and the committee administrator for the efforts that they've gone to, and we believe that these amendments accomplish what you're attempting to get to.
Okay. I think what I'll do is I'll just leave you gentlemen there. Mr. Hearn, you want to come forward from, and just in case we develop some questions, we can not have everybody have to go back and forth. And get your thoughts on the Dash 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Pat Hearn, Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Accountancy. And Mr. Chair, I'd like you to know that the Chair and Vice Chair of the Board are also here this afternoon.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, relative to the Dash 2 amendments, the provision to set the fees for licenses issued by the Board of Accountancy statute came as an absolute surprise to the Board. The Board has not proposed a fee increase since 1999. The Oregon fees for CPAs are amongst the lowest in the country. We have reviewed surrounding states as an example. Ours are currently $150 for 2 years. Arizona's $300 for 2 years. Nevada's $140 a year. In Washington, it's just a couple of dollars more than we are at $230 for 3 years. The Board does have rulemaking authority to set its fees and would certainly judiciously exercise that authority were the mobility legislation to pass and it was determined that it had a detrimental effect on the Board's operating revenues.
Okay, so I interpret from that you would prefer to continue to set those in rule based on what you felt it need to operate as opposed to putting them in statute then?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Hearn?
Do you have others? Do you have a question, sir?
Do you have others you would like to have testify, Mr. Hearn?
I believe Jim Gaffney, our chair, and Ray Johnson, our vice chair, would like to make brief comments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Then I'll go ahead and ask people to step aside and ask those two gentlemen to come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gaffney. I'm chair of the Oregon Board of Accountancy and a practicing CPA in Portland, Oregon.
Mr. Chair, member of this committee, I'm vice chair of the Oregon Board of Accountancy. I'm on faculty at Portland State University. I'm a CPA and licensed in the state of Oregon.
And your name?
You didn't say the name. Raymond Johnson.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Thank you. You wish to comment on the legislation as amended?
Well, first, Mr. Chair, thanks for moving the work session from April 15th till today. We've been swamped in this, and it's been hard to give too much attention to this during our so-called busy season, but we've worked with OSCPA on this over the past best part of a year, and it's actually part of a further effort that started before last session. And in fact, is even more a longer effort that goes back to, this is about the fourth or fifth Uniform Accountancy Act, and is part of a general effort to have more consistency between the states with respect to the rules and the standards that we practice by. And so we saw Dash 2 for the first time this morning. We've also studied Dash 1 and the bill in great detail, and the unanimous position of the Board of Accountancy is that we're opposed to Senate Bill 867, and the Dash amendments that we've seen don't change our mind from what we've talked about so far, although the Board hasn't taken a formal position yet with respect to Dash 1 or Dash 2, just because of time.
Help me with one thing, because
the testimony by the proponents, who are also CPAs, your CPAs, say that this is, for the most part, reciprocity for the majority of states is how we practice accounting. So help me understand this, because I'm perplexed by the accountants that practice in other states have similar, identical or similar legislation in most other states. You practice. Help me understand why that would be why it should be different in Oregon than these other places in which you yourselves may practice at times.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we embrace the concept of mobility. We're not opposed to it. It's a question of how. And our responsibility goes beyond what the, our brothers and sisters in public accounting are doing with OSCPA is we also are charged with watching out for the public. And the part that we're concerned about isn't where out-of-state CPAs come and practice here, and the firm currently out-of-state CPAs have to register one by one with the board, and that's that concept is something that was adopted from an earlier Uniform Accountancy Act. So we were doing what the national groups suggested that we all do, and it would be a better system. Now they want to do something less than that. What they are advocating overall is what they've, the metaphor they've used, the example they've used is the driver's license approach. That if someone has a good driver's license in Nevada, it ought to be good in Oregon. And and we have some problems with that. The idea is that there's implied consent to enforcement by the Oregon Board of Accountancy against licensees that come here, as opposed to the express consent we have when individually they give us notice and pay a fee. And so part of it, we think we have a solution for, where the firms have an office in the state and the firms are registered with the state, we think there's enough protection there that we can, that the public will be protected. But the ones we're concerned about and where we aren't on common ground yet is where the out-of-state licensees don't have, aren't with a firm that's registered here. So it's purely the implied consent. And the example that they like to use of the driver's license, when we've looked into that, what we understand is the only reason that works is because there's interstate compacts to make that work, to allow the one state where the offense occurs to be able to have enforcement authority over someone from out of state. And that part is missing. And we've talked to, they brought representatives out from the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, American Institute of CPAs in October. We spent some time with them and talked this through, and they conceded, too, that that is something that would make this work better. And our point is, why rush into that part of it? Why not stay with status quo with respect to that part of it until this other part gets done? And their solution is, well, let's go ahead and do it now anyway, and we'll come back to that. This is part of an effort that's gone on for my entire career. It goes back to the mid-'80s, the efforts to have the standardization of these rules. We've demonstrated our support for that, not us, because it's, all of us have, and predecessors to Ray and I on the Board of Accountancy. We all want the same thing. It's a matter of how we do it, and not just racing into it to try to do it in a way that still protects the public and doesn't overlook things where they might get hurt. Otherwise, we're arm in arm.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that, as Jim says, a lot of our concern relates to out-of-state firms and firm registration part of this, not the individual mobility piece of this, but I think they have to go together. And our concern is about protecting the public. I think we also have some concerns with some definitional issues, and certainly I think the board with the Dash 2 amendments is very concerned about setting fees and statute.
Okay. Questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess here's my look at this is that we have a situation where most people who engage out-of-state firms are fairly large, sophisticated financial entities, meaning companies that may have cross-state efforts. If you're an in-state business, you hire in-state accountants. And so what we're talking about is fairly sophisticated consumers. As you just said, you're here to protect the consumer. So I'm not really buying that argument. What I'm concerned about here is that it really looks like the board is an effort trying to eliminate competition. And I want you to discuss this because from my perspective, I can't see how the consumer would be hurt by this. In fact, the consumer is actually hindered by the current system the way it is right now because they can't get easy access to out-of-state accountants nearly easy enough, and what you're really doing is creating a barrier to entry into our market. So it seems like we've hurt the consumer two different ways, and I can't really see how we're hurting the consumer the other way, in as much as the people who hire out-of-state accountants are typically very financially savvy corporations, businesses, individuals. So if you address those two issues, I really appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, let me give you an example then of a case that's just come up to the board, and we know that there's several lined up behind them, and it's not an audit or review or any of that type of thing. It's the selling of tax shelters to a small business sale through several generations of a family, and now it's time to sell, and there's a large gain. And an out-of-state licensee was the one allegedly in this case that presented the idea, involved other CPAs that were here. That CPA then leaves the state, and we are in a very difficult situation to try to do anything with respect to that CPA. We can do things with the Oregon licensed CPAs, but we shouldn't. But we should be able to get to all the CPAs that are involved in this if we find that there was a fault in that. So I would disagree with, certainly there are the cases that you're describing, but it's not limited to that by any means. You said you had two questions. I don't know if that answers both of them or...
The other one has to do with about eliminating competition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator George. The substantial equivalency status quo that we have right now, where someone that meets our qualifications, has the hour requirements of formal education, has passed the test, has the experience, all those types of things, and then fills out a one-page form online and pays a $100 fee for a one-year permit to practice here. That concept, that barrier to trade and all that came from American Institute of CPAs and National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. And it was good enough for them 4 years ago. We don't mind trying to improve on it, but we're not. This isn't our idea. This isn't something that we've created to try and protect Oregon CPAs by any means.
One last follow-up. If you came into this committee very often, or any of the other business committees that I sit on, you would find that I'm a huge advocate for getting fee-setting authority back into statute. Other funds now make up 51% of our total budget in the state, somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 billion per biennium is being done in other funds. And more agencies are asking for rule-writing authority to set fees. The problem is that, in essence, takes the legislature out of its number one responsibility, which is to raise revenue and to oversee the raising of revenue. And I'd hope, if I could urge your board to recognize that it really is a separation of powers issue, and there's a lot of us up, you know, that are dealing with these bills that would like to see almost all, if every single fee put into state statute rather than through rule. So, if that would just a comment,
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the other side of that coin is that a board can lose its independence when it loses its ability to set its fees, and it can be held captive and to have its best judgment compromise when trade associations have more political clout than the board does. And so I very well understand the point that you're making. I would just offer that other vantage point.
The danger of democracy, Mr. Chairman. So,
any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The last person I have to testify is Keith Myers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Keith Myers. I'm a CPA practicing in Portland, Oregon, also chair of the Oregon Society's Legislative Policy Committee. I just wanted to thank you for the time here working with you on this legislative proposal. As Mr. Gaffney had stated, we've been working with the Board of Accountancy more on and off for over 2 years on this legislation, and we have drafted this legislation as well as we could to make sure that we have dealt with the public issues and in public protection on this in addition to everything else. However, we would really appreciate this legislative moving forward at this point in time. I'm here to answer any additional questions that you might have.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Myers? Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We do not yet have a fiscal on this amendment, the Dash 2 amendment, and so, but we have, for the purposes of the record, taken testimony on the amendment today. This bill will also roll over to Wednesday, when at such time we should have a fiscal impact on the amendment. So with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 867. Members, I'm going to bind here. I'm 10 minutes early on 101. I did say I wouldn't start till 2:15 on that, although I think most of the people are here. But I'm a little nervous about letting you guys go and have you come back. If you will please assure me that you will be back in 9 minutes so we can get going on that, I would really appreciate it. And then, you know, take a brief little break. Can we do that? All right. We'll be recessed until, you guys are just more efficient than I thought we would be, till 2:15.
Okay, we'll return from the recess for business and transportation. It is 1:17, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 101. Mr. Stenbridge, you might just give us a brief recap. And
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 101 requires the State Department of Energy to establish greenhouse gas emissions performance standards for electricity generating facilities. You have the dash 3 and the dash 4 amendments, which we received this morning, and so we have none of the paperwork to back those up, but we do have the dash 3 and dash 4.
Okay, Mr. Graney, you want to come forward and discuss the dash 3 amendment for us, please?
We've made the copies of the amendment available to anybody who needs one, and
okay.
If anybody would like to email the committee office, we can send an electronic copy of the amendments as well.
That'd be good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy, and with me is Lisa Farling from the Public Utility Commission. And this bill, Senate Bill 101, you had had a hearing on some time ago. We have been working with the different interested parties to try to reach a consensus. We are close, reached consensus on most issues, but not all of them, and that's in part evidenced by the fact that you had both a dash 3 and a dash 4. But the working group did work very hard, and I think would continue to be willing to work on this if the committee passes the bill out to try to reach complete consensus over on the House side. If you'd like, I could go through the bill briefly.
Please do that. I don't necessarily mean section by section, but I'd like to, because we have the bill, I want to know what this primarily alters from the original version.
Mr. Chairman, in some respects, it gives more clarity as to regulatory responsibilities. It does establish an emission performance standard for power plants for greenhouse gases, so it's part of the governor's climate change package of legislation. Section 2 establishes the standard for investor-owned utilities and electric service providers that are regulated by the Public Utility Commission, and it provides a limit of 1,100 pounds of greenhouse gas per megawatt hour in statute. Also authorizes the PUC, after consultation with our agency, to amend that standard no more often than every 3 years. There's a parallel standard for consumer-owned utilities in Section 3 that we, in turn, can modify every 3 years after consultation with the PUC. So the intent is to have identical standards. In the case of consumer-owned utilities, they make their own decisions and determinations, but we do have a monitoring role. Section 4 then establishes provisions that no long-term power contracts can be entered into by investor-owned utilities unless the source of that power meets the standards established in the bill. Sequestration as a method of meeting that standard is explicitly authorized and recognized. The PUC can also approve provisions if, for example, a plant currently does not meet the standard but would over within 7 years through plans and modifications by the owner. PUC can also exempt a power plant in the event of reliability issues or severe financial harm or unexpected catastrophic issues such as, floods and other unanticipated consequences. There's a similar section in Section 5, then, regarding consumer-owned utilities with comparable provisions for the consumer-owned utilities. Under Section 6 of the law, the Public Utility Commission may only approve an integrated resource plan, or acknowledge, I guess is the correct term, integrated resource plan, if it's consistent with the standards established in the bill. Sections 7 and 8 are work together. Section 8 first. It's kind of written backwards. Section 8 establishes that under the Energy Facility Siting Law, a sequestration facility is an energy facility for purposes of siting approval from the Energy Facility Siting Council. And Section 7 then directs the Department of Energy to work with DEQ, Dalgami, State Lands and Water Resources to establish standards to implement standards for siting a sequestration facility. And as a matter of course, we work with them and with additional agencies in the Siting Council's rulemaking. Section 9 updates the Siting Council exemption for industrial cogeneration facilities and also explicitly authorizes the Siting Council to update that standard over time through rule rather than having to come back to the legislature for legislative approval. Section 10 then provides ODO and the PUC with rulemaking authority, and also is that the section that includes a study by the commission? And then Section 11 includes a study by the commission of on the rate impacts of the legislation. And then Section 12 provides that the effective date of the Act is July 1st, 2010. We mentioned a couple of the issues that there was not complete agreement on, and that the language in the bill doesn't reflect total agreement. One was the issue of extension of contracts for existing facilities. And the language that is provided in the bill now provides that as long as the facility does not exceed its current level of emissions, that it complies with the standard. There were people who thought that was too weak. There were also people who thought that that was too strict a standard, but that's where we ended up in terms of the legislation. There was also an issue regarding additional investments that would extend the life of the power plant, but that is authorized under the bill as drafted. Finally, the dash fours, there's a provision that in addition to the regulatory framework for carbon sequestration that's in sections 7 and 8 already, appears somewhat duplicative, but has DEQ take the lead on establishing standards for CO2 emissions, but works with the same agencies that are listed in the Dash 3 amendments. And because it's additive, may cause some confusion just to how those sections interact. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions or go into more detail on this.
Okay. Let's start with that. Questions for Mr. Granger and Mr. Sparling on the Dash 3 amendment at this time? I know we just all kind of got it. Okay, that's fine for now.
Okay.
We'll step aside. Mr. Gallagher from Portland General Electric or Mr. McCarthy. Okay. And I would ask
Chair,
a couple of things. Yes, go ahead.
I may have missed something. It says the Dash 3 start on page 11. It says remove pages 1 through 10 of the Dash 3s.
Of the original bill. Yeah.
Okay.
And again, this is fresh stuff. We're going to look at this. We're not moving this bill today.
Right.
What I want to do is, in our time, though, is get the amendments and proposed amendments before us. And I'm sure everybody will be visited on them, but I want to get this out on the record first. So, Mr. McCarthy, after you identify yourself, I'd like first to have your comments on the Dash 3/4 amendments from your perspective, and then discuss the amendment that I don't know if you have a working copy of it, we're about to get, and we'll go into that one next, because that's the next one on the table.
Absolutely. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy, representing PGE today. As I read the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s, I'm not sure that either actually adequately represents the work group language, because there are some pieces that are that PGE wants in both, and I'm not sure that the entire work group language got into both. But if you look at the Dash 4s, there, as Director Graney pointed out, there are a couple of differences between the agency bill and ours. In lines 10 and 11 on page 1 of the Dash 4s, the in a manner that does not increase annual emissions or exceed those emissions associated with the previous contract, we're asking that language actually be struck. And you'll see that in the working draft that you'll get a copy of in front of you in just a second. The reason is because when we extend under existing contracts, we have a contract for delivery of a certain amount of electricity. that obligates someone to sell us that at all the time. If for some reason they can't deliver, they have to find another resource. It's not always possible to determine the emissions under an existing contract. Sometimes we get unspecified resources. We get electricity out of a power pool, and they deliver that power. So we're concerned that in extending a contract, we cannot guarantee that our emissions will not exceed that of the one under the previous contract. But it's important to look at this as an extension of an existing contract and this bill as a limit on no new coal. So we're looking to just extend long-term contracts that we have for baseload electricity and continue them because we're, for a variety of reasons, we're not going to broaden those contracts, but just to renew them. And we view that as being consistent with the purposes of this bill. The other, I think, important thing to point out, and it, again, is not in either bill, but it's a question of concept of life extension and investments that would extend the life of a plant. And we've talked this over and over in the work group, and ultimately we get to a point where it's difficult to ensure that there's not going to be an unforeseen situation that would be hung up by life extension language. So we appreciate the conversations that have happened, but right now it's difficult to look at the concept of life extension and ensure that at some point in time in the future we're not going to have some circumstance where the argument about the investment is happening at the worst possible time. A good example would be when our Boardman turbine failed, we had $400,000 a day in replacement power costs while we were getting that turbine repaired. We also do not want to be in a situation of arguing over whether the turbine repair is a life extension of the plant or not at the same time. We need to get that plant back up online. It's the best thing for our customers at the time.
So I assume that's going to be embodied in the amendment that you're putting
forward. It would be, yes.
Yeah, just back to the Dash 4, though. Are there other issues with the Dash 4 besides those that are not going to be covered in your amendment that you want to propose?
There are not.
Okay. So then why don't we move forward to your proposed amendments? I know we don't have the actual copy of it, but we might have a work copy.
You have a working copy.
Okay. Well, that'll be helpful. Okay. And then if you could walk us through, Mr. McCarthy, the major amendment changes here to Senate Bill 101 and your explanation for those.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, again, the primary differences in our amendments in front of you as compared to what you may see from the agency or the Dash 3s or 4s is realistically only in on the Dash 4s, line 10 and 11 on the first page. We would be good with the rest of the Dash 4s as is. And really, as Director Green pointed out, we're very close. I mean, what we're talking about are some real angels dancing on the head of a pin here. There are questions. PGE supports the emissions performance standard. Generally, we're together on 97%+ of the bill. It is really only the question of extending the contracts that are existing contracts and the question of life extension language.
Some of that language is in the amendment you just handed out to us.
Yeah.
Would you go over that for us, please?
Sure. In the amendment in front of you on page 1, you'll see in the margin we are deleting in a manner that does not increase annual emissions or exceed those emissions associated with the previous contract. We're also adding of 5 or more years to ensure those are long-term contracts and long-term contracts only. PGE has 2 of those, and we would be interested in making sure that we can extend those without penalty. You will note that there is a change on page 2 to the definition of generating facility. This is the term generating facility is used throughout the bill, but generally speaking, you're going to want to make sure that you look at the definition of long-term financial commitment because it directly relates to long-term financial commitment in a generating facility. Our language uses includes. The language that was submitted by the agency changed that to means. The original bill language used the term includes, and we would like to keep it that way. We think that that also is a question of unforeseen problems. And then the last change that we would ask the committee to make is on page 9. It's your third page, apparently. And at the end of section 6, we would delete all of the language relating to life extension, which is all the language in the margin.
And Ms. McCarthy or Mr. Gallagher, would you elaborate a little bit on why that you believe that's important?
Well, again, the question of life extension and investments of life that extend the life of a plant is something that's difficult for us to ensure that at some point in time in the future we will not have a situation where we need to invest in a plant, and then that's when the argument happens. We need to ensure that there are not some sort of unforeseen things that happen. We don't know. We can't look into our crystal ball and find all of them, but we do know that potentially at some point in time there will be an argument over what the unforeseen circumstance is. Go ahead, Tom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing PGE. Just to quickly answer your question, our understanding is this bill is for future generation. And there are a couple things here that reach back into the other generation. It's our view that the way we do the carbon reduction plan, Incentive Bill 80, or whatever happens there, that's where we should be going back looking at plans that reduce, excuse me, that reduce actual carbon in our existing generation. So life expectancy would be a plant that we're operating right now. To reduce carbon in that plant probably should be done under Senate Bill 80 and not under emission performance standards.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Starr.
It looks like in the dash 3s and 4s, any subsection 4 has already been deleted. I can't seem to find what that deleted information might be, so I'm getting nods from Mr. Greeny. So apparently that's already taken out of this. Is that...
Okay. So...
Other questions at the moment? Senator George? Go ahead. I mean, Tom, you want to talk to Tom?
Yeah, well, it didn't matter either one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, apparently there was another set of amendments that was submitted by the agency. So my confusion apparently is that they've already agreed with the deletion of the life extension language and the change to generating facility. So, apparently I'm catching up.
Okay. Because one thing we
apologize for the confusion.
That's okay. Well, we just got the amendments this morning ourselves. So one of the things we have to do is trying to reconcile what the changes are and where the areas of disagreement are for the committee to make a decision on. That's what I'm trying to drive at here. So. Senator George, go ahead.
Gentlemen, I'm having a hard time with the concept of knowing what we're creating as far as the impact on the consumer, the ratepayer. And I'm a little uncomfortable. State agencies are actually advocating for this. Governor, the executive branch is advocating for this. I understand the position that PGE is in because you're simply taking public policy and implementing it, whatever we say. Where would I go to find good numbers on what a proposal like this would actually cost ratepayers long term, including all the different green energy things we're doing? I'm having a hard time figuring out where to even go to get information about how much this will add to the cost for ratepayers, both businesses and individuals. Where would be a source of information?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I don't think there is one yet, because what we're talking about in our amendments are speculations on things which we haven't quite identified. We don't know. So there's no way to tell. We know what our replacement power costs for Boardman were 2 years ago. We don't really know. We think the issue here is fairly specific. We're in agreement with building new generation or going forward with generation that would adhere to a carbon reduction standard. Because we have in-state generation, because we're a short utility that buys about 20% of our power on the market, because we have the RPS, which we're going to have to go forward and change out our generation, and because right now the PUC has a carbon IRP process, whether Senate Bill 80 or some variation thereof passes, there's going to be a review of all of our operating procedures in front of the PUC. So we think that's the place to look at these speculative unknown pieces of cost and to put them all together, as opposed to simply trying to use the emission performance standard to reach back for existing generation.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, then, from what you're saying, is that before you would add any additional power supplies to your portfolio, you would have to go to the PUC. So I'm trying to figure out even the purpose of this bill, meaning it seems like to me that if the PUC had a policy saying we're going to encourage you to have options that are non-coal burning, why we would need this piece of legislation at all, other than to make it more difficult to go towards coal if we ever found a coal process that people accepted, or rates got so incredibly high that coal would be a reasonable place to sign a contract quickly. I can't figure out what this bill does that we couldn't do under current law or current rule writing.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think generally we agree with that, given some of the decisions of the PUC and the Pacific Core IRP process and some of the activities that the Department of Energy has right now on gas turbines. But when a bill like this comes forward, we try to do our best to comply with the policy and make it work for our ratepayers. And I think that's what we're trying to do with these amendments. If we don't get our amendments, then you have to question the basics of what the impact the bill would have going forward in the future on our ratepayers.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
I have a question, Mr. Gallagher, Mr. McCarthy, and colleagues. The Section 12 of the Dash 4, and it's the Section 11 of the Dash 3, is actually my amendment. It was not supposed to be included in the department's amendment. It is designed as one little minor issue with it, because it's supposed to be every biennium, but is to require the Public Utility Commission to do an estimate of the rate impacts on rate payers for all the different legislation that we pass, and beginning with those that have already been put into statute and prepared by November of 2010, and then every biennium thereafter, which is what still has to be included for future legislation. I would like to have your comments on that provision.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think what Section 11 represents is a lot of what the Balanced Climate Coalition and the utilities were writing in their bill, that we should go ahead and do the planning and some implementation and continuously report back to the legislature, which would have a lot of the cost factor and a lot of the elements in it. So we've been very supportive of this. I think pieces of this are in the amendments to Dash 3 and the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 80, but they're not laid out as specifically as you've done it here. I think politically it's very important that all policymakers understand on a regular basis what the costs are going to be and have it done by a decision-making body like the PUC as you go forward with carbon reduction. I think that would be very helpful on the policy side.
Yeah, because colleagues, I think one of the things that's really important, as you know, with rate making and costs are things that I'm very concerned about. And I realize they've been working hard on other pieces of legislation about trying to define extraordinary costs, but what's extraordinary to my neighbor may be a lot less standard than it is to someone else. And I just want to make sure that we continue to balance the debate between our policies, which are important, but also know what is the cost of that policy. And I know just recently, the last week or so, been reading things, and I don't know if it's from your utility, but others estimating different potential costs on ratepayers. But what is really important is that independent body, the Public Utility Commission, to be able to take that information and be able to convey to the public, this is how much this will probably cost ratepayers. I just think it's the transparency piece, no matter what we do or what we do in the future, is to make ensure that we utilize the PUC for their role, which is to tell us, what is the cost of different policies that we implement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are people from the PUC that could answer this better than I in a better way. For PGE, the numbers we came out with were cost numbers of what we thought, based on what we knew in the bills, that it would cost us going forward to replace our generating capacity and so forth. Cost numbers are different than rate numbers. There are a number of processes that a rate making goes through, which has all the different parties to participate. And in most cases, the utility rate numbers come down because of the process itself and because of the input from other people. And I think to some extent it may be difficult for the PUC to actually tell you what a rate number is until after the rate case. They may be able to give you cost impact numbers, but I think Mr. Sparling would be much better at describing that than I.
That's accurate, and I think that's why it's important when we talk about giving estimates, so we have some idea of what that might be anticipated. Senator Starr?
Yeah, just to add, I mean, this is especially important when you look at the state of our economy and 12%+ unemployment. These grandiose ideas of greenhouse gas reductions and all of this sounds great when the economy is rolling and folks can afford to pay these extra costs, but particularly business interests that hopefully are employing Oregonians. We need to know. We need to have this information. It's too critically important for us not to, as we make, you know, these policy choices in a vacuum and don't know how they're impacting our economy. I don't need necessarily a response. I'd welcome one, but in some respects, it's kind of a rhetorical statement.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think that it's my personal feeling and that you're going to be involved in carbon going on toward the numbers that are in statute 468A. It has a date of 2020, and these things will be coming online in pieces and for utilities probably in large chunks. So I don't think this is a case of being able to sit down, look at a bill at one point in time, get it perfect, and send it spinning off. I think both politically and economically, the legislature will constantly be, and I know all of the bill drafts have reports back to the legislature, and as in terms of the current economic environment, you know, there's always an argument, well, the economy will come back, and so these things will be better in the future. At least the numbers we've been looking at PGE to meet the 2020 date and the goals that are in the statute, the costs as we perceive them right now are extremely high, and they're not going to be implemented all at one time. So a reporting back mechanism, whatever bill passes, makes sense.
Well, the statement that these costs are extremely high certainly give me pause.
It's for one reason, Mr. Gallagher, because you don't have the generating capacity that you own to provide for the customers, and you have to go to market for a lot of this?
Mr. Chair, the costs are built on essentially three separate categories. One is just meeting regular load growth. The other is anticipated costs for complying with the renewable energy standard, and the last would be to meet the carbon goals, whatever they are. And so that does involve the building out of quite a lot of generation, both wind, utility-scale wind, and natural gas-fired power plants, and then potentially some other non-emitting high-capacity resource as yet unidentified.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, for those of you that are in PGE territory, there's just an anomaly in the date 1990. The PGE portfolio in 1990 included a great deal of hydro contracts, which have since lapsed, which are non-carbon emitting, and included Trojan Nuclear Power, which for all of its negatives and downsides was carbon-free. It had other environmental impacts that were serious, but it was carbon-free. So the amount of reduction that PGE has to go through to get to 30% below that number requires us to build out a great deal more generation than if we'd have had 100% carbon portfolio at that time. It's just the amount of new generation we have to build to get to that point. I don't think that was an intention of anybody to create a date that would do that to PGE. I think that number came out of some scientific Kyoto information in the Carbon Allocation Task Force that meant in the early 2000s actually used that number, which is why it came forward into the goals. But not normalizing PGE for those particular activities, for those of you that in PGE's rate territory, the cost would be extremely high.
Any other questions for this group? Thank you. Who else would like to testify on Senate Bill 101? Jeff?
I guess I'm having a big guess in my office.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayers. And to Representative George's question of where do you get good information, our general view is that the place where you don't get it is the utility, because they tend to have a self-interest in keeping their numbers high. We finally, after many weeks of asking for the their estimations of kind of pretty scary costs at the end and rate impacts that they've been putting out there, finally sat some folks from PGE finally sat down with my executive director Bob Jenks on Friday, and this information is basically a quick report he did, where we are putting together a better analysis and a better summary of the information that they put together. But his overall comment was that basically their assumptions, if we believe the rate impacts, were that a utility would either have to be acting imprudently, would have to be doing no additional energy efficiency investment beyond what they were doing last year, and would be charging illegal rates as of 2020 for resources that they said would no longer be in existence. So the analysis that my boss was provided was not something that we would be willing to take to the bank. It's like in terms of looking at the actual rate impacts of these policies. I think the approach that the chair takes in his amendments is a very good one, and one we support, and one that is the intention behind Senate Bill 80, is to have the plan and have a solid plan that everybody gets to see the numbers, and it's not just made up in a back room somewhere, and to really have good, solid analysis and have a good, solid agreement on, these are going to be the rate impacts, and then we can make the policy decision, what are we actually paying for? Because when we look at rate impacts, what we look at is what's the value to the consumer? Is the consumer getting any value for this or not? And if we believe that, and we are not a low rates at all cost consumer group, we recognize that there are costs that need to be paid to run a reliable utility system for all consumers. And so there are some things that we will not pay for. Getting back to 101 specifically, what we don't want is for resources that are cheap economically today that will be getting more expensive over time. It was only about 2 years ago that we were arguing with the utility over a proposed 2 to 4 new coal plants in their proposed integrated resource plan. We opposed those, the proposed coal plants, because although they would be cheap today, with increased carbon regulation in 10, 20, 30 years over the very long lives of those plants, they would start to become increasingly expensive. And the concern for us is that the consumer takes all the risk in terms of potential increases because of increased carbon regulation, which we believe is coming, and rightfully so. And so what we want is to protect consumers and make sure that we are not making those decisions today that are going to heavily impact all consumers, both residential and business consumers, on down the line. And so, to answer your question about where do you get good information, it's actually, I think, through the regulatory process, through the creation of a record that the PUC then makes a decision on, because there is the ability to do some substantial analysis and to trade information back and forth in terms of data requests and that sort of thing. And so it's an iterative process, and one that we hope that the legislature provides the authority to start to undertake, and provides real instruction to go forth and start to consider carbon and carbon effects in rates after this legislative session, because right now we don't have that authority, or at least not as explicitly as we would like, and we don't have the authority to pursue that line of questioning sort of to a point in time. And right now what we have is legislative goals, and so that's what we're looking for in larger climate policy, and for this at least the agreement that indeed we are not going to be investing in coal going forward. And I think some of the differences that you're hearing in terms of this bill is what's the definition of going forward? Is it sort of a catastrophic event for a particular resource, or are we really trying to make investments in a plant that is going to extend that life for 20 or 30 years, and consumers are going to bear the cost of that?
Okay, thank you. I got 5 minutes left here. I've got two people asked to talk, so you have about 2 minutes each, so I'm going to get you on. Joe, you could stay here if someone has a question, but I want to, Joe Hesman, Steve Weiss, if you want to come forward, give me a couple of brief comments on the record, and then we're done here in 3.5-4 minutes.
Mr. Chair, may I make a couple of comments while they're coming up? I just like to tell you that legislators are consumer protection agency. That's what we do. We have to report back to all these people that we represent. But industry is not a bad thing. And I was not clear on what organization you represent.
The Citizen Utility Board of Oregon.
I'm sorry that I don't have more time, because I'd like to banter with you just a bit.
Okay, I'll come by.
Well, banter off, and then we're going to banter again in committee. But I want to get a couple comments here before we close out.
My name is Stephen Weiss from Northwest Energy Coalition. Just wanted to address a couple things. Mr. Galler said that this was, and Senator George asked the question, well, why do we need this if the climate legislation passes? And I'd like to point out Section 3. Well, it's on a, like the dash threes on page 3, lines 19 through 25, that, and page 6, lines 19 through 25, that that the commission is allowed, if review that other legislation has been done through state or federal law, which would supersede this legislation, and this could be voided or recommended to be voided. And the reason is because there is a good chance that we will not have climate legislation, and this will be a very important long-run goal to limit future coal use in this for the citizens of Oregon. We are, when people look at the costs, you have to also look at the costs of doing nothing. The environmental costs of global warming are estimated to be huge. And so the idea that we're only going to look at today's costs are very short-sighted. Finally, PGE, an analysis they did a couple weeks ago, a public analysis on shutting down Boardman, what would the cost of shutting down Boardman under various scenarios, shutting it down in 2020, 2029, 2040, and so on, replacing the power with natural gas, fired power, or other resources. There were something like 60 different scenarios, but in those scenarios, the average came out to be maybe $20 million a year, which on their revenue requirement of close to $3 billion a year is within the 1-2% rate impact. So reaching these goals is not going to cost us 20-30% rate increases. We'd have to see PGE's own assessment of shutting down Boardman, which is the vast, most of their carbon emissions. Their own estimate shows it would not be more than 1-2% rate increase. So I think before they keep throwing around these numbers, they should put them out publicly so we can all analyze them.
That's one thing I attempt to do with our having the PUC look at it.
Yes,
Mr. Esmond.
That would be good.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. I am Joe Esmond from the IBEW Local 48, the electrical workers in Portland, Oregon area, representing about 3,800 people who are ratepayers. And these same ratepayers We'll see the bills go up. This, these same ratepayers, my members, will see the factories and the, like Intel say, like Schnitzer Steel, Blue Heron, stuff like that, where our members go to work all the time. They'll be out of work. I would like to see an economic impact statement from this bill and all the other bills that are floating around here to see. I think we can get some, if we go to the Oregon Economic Development Council and get their money that they spend to go around the country and overseas to attract businesses to this state, forget it. They don't need the money because nobody's going to come here. So we can take that $1 million and use it for something else. I cannot believe, and my members cannot believe, with 12.1% unemployment, you're going to do all this stuff. You are responsible to your people in your districts. The biggest thing right now is jobs. The guy waiting for the bus over there, he's either worried about his job, going to a job interview, or just got shot down from a job interview. Now let's just, and I'm not trying to vent at you, senators, but I'm venting, so when's enough enough? Maybe we can go with this PUC type commission, do a study, but don't send out the wrong signals that we're not open for business. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Asman. Committee members, well, Mr. Stembridge, you might, as you know, this is the week we have to get things out, so we'll probably be going our full length, but maybe talk about Wednesday briefly.
We have 6 work sessions scheduled for Wednesday, plus we have 3 that we've carried over from today, and I don't know if you, anyone carried Senate Bill 101.
I think we'll carry it over. We'll continue to roll over until Wednesday and roll over till Thursday as necessary.
Okay. We have utility relocation, Columbia River Crossing, and vehicles, something about the Pacific Wonderland.
Oh, yeah, license plate. Yeah, I love that bill.
This
okay. We're adjourned.
Is this,